Thanks for listening to Matt McLaughlin History. Become a subscriber to receive exclusive bonus episodes, ad-free listening, early access to all episodes, and special member-only events. Click on the link in the show notes or visit patreon.com/mmhistory.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
A Living History production.
This is the Living History Podcast, broadcasting live across the airwaves.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the next in our installment of dedicated Gallipoli specials. I can't even remember what number we're up to. I think it's five that we're up to, five of eight. And what a journey it has been. We have covered so many interesting aspects, so many parts of the Gallipoli campaign that even I didn't know about, and I thought I knew everything about Gallipoli. Interestingly, though, there is someone who does know everything about Gallipoli, and it's the man I'm talking to right now. It's Mr. Peter Hart. Pete, here we are again. It's a great journey so far, isn't it?
It's been great fun, and I do not know everything. I know what I know, and I don't know a lot. But for both of us, it's my main interest. It's a fabulous. And so this week we're doing the conditions at Gallipoli. It's a bit wide range. It gives people a bit of a chance just to get the feel of what it was like to be there. In the sense, you can never do that because you're not sat in boiling sunshine with people shooting at you and wanting to go to the loo every 5 minutes. But you can get that the feeling, because it is a terrible, terrible place to fight. People say it's the worst campaign ever. It's not. But it's very bad, isn't it? And there's something unique about it. What would you say that is? What do you think is the most unique aspect of Gallipoli?
I think you're right, Pete. I think, you know, when it comes to the terrain, the environment, fighting a war is always going to be hard. But in these conditions, particularly at places like Anzac, where there are effectively ants clinging onto the side of a hill, but also at Helles, which was some pretty rough country as well. And I'm really looking forward to this one, because as you say, this is a bit more of a discussion about, okay, we're here, we're stuck. You know, what's it like to be stuck in those trenches day in, day out? And so far we've done the naval campaign, we've done the landings, we've done all the fighting at Helles. Oh, and I always forget my housekeeping. Don't forget, if you want to listen to all the episodes, you can. Pete's laughing at me. I always forget to say this. This is important to say. My producer will kill me if I don't. You can download all the episodes by subscribing. Click on the link in the show notes and get all the episodes at once, so you don't have to wait week to week. I'm pretty sure that a lot of people listening to this have subscribed already and are listening to it all in one go. So thank you very much for your subscription. But if you want all 8, 10, 12 hours, however long it's going to end up being, you can get it by subscribing. So please do that. And lots of bonus content as well. But into this week's episode, conditions at Gallipoli. It's going to be a fascinating one, Pete, because I think the one thing that was unique about Gallipoli, not necessarily unique of all battlefields, but certainly compared to what we talk about in France and Belgium, was this concept that there was no rear area. You know, in France, people were going, they were going back behind the lines, they were having a bath, they were having a drink in an estaminet when they were out of the front line. Sometimes they were going as far back as Paris. British soldiers were getting leave in London. I mean, this is a serious break from the terror and the awful conditions in the front line, but there was no option for that at Gallipoli. If you're in the rear area, you're almost as much at risk of getting killed as you were in the front line, and it was awful in the rear area as well.
Yeah, and imagine the stress. And you've got a quote that you found that I think sums it up beautifully. Sergeant Cyril Lawrence, a 2nd Australian Field Company, he's an engineer, he's a sapper. What does he say?
He had to say, "You Australians away back at home in sunny Australia with your comfortable beds, your good food, your cities, your own home folk, think. Just think ever so little, stir yourselves and try to imagine our feelings. Here we have been for 19 weeks, in danger of being hit any minute, bullets flying over and around you day and night, and great shells that get you wherever you try to hide, and no matter how you dig in. living in a position in which there is not one single spot immune from bullet or shell, not one single crevice where a man can say, I am safe. And, mate, wow. Doesn't that sum it up? It's just this idea of... I mean, and all he's talking about there is the risk of death. He's not even talking about there the fact of the flies and the corpses and the disease and the dysentery and everything else that's going on. I just don't think we can get our heads around how horrific this place was.
No, and the sheer physic, that the tension caused a lot of what we now call PTSD, post-traumatic stress disorder, because it is stressful. I think that quote just sums it up. The physical conditions, they are bad. You mentioned the geography, the climate, the terrain, the flies, bloody everything else. But there's also a logistical set of problems, isn't there? They're 800 miles from Alexandria in Egypt, which is the nearest big port. That in itself is, oh, God, I should never have started that. 2,500 miles. I may be making that up. I told you I didn't know it all. From England. It's a bit further from Australia land.
A bit further.
And there's not, I mean, at even the rear areas at Mudros and Lemnos, they haven't got a proper port. They haven't got anything. They've got to build it, everything they have to build. And because
we made this point in other episodes too, Pete, that the Turks behind them have all of Turkey. You know, they've got all of the peninsula, which they occupy, except for the little beachhead. And then that leads all the way back to Constantinople. They've got the whole of their country, the whole of the Ottoman Empire behind them, to bring up supplies, to rest in, to train, to manufacture arms and food and everything else they need to bring to the front line. The Allies have nothing. The Allies have a couple of kilometres of Turkish dirt and then nothing but the deep blue sea behind them all the way back to where their supply bases are. And as we know, armies run on logistics. It's the least sexy part. The shooting and the bayonet fighting and the grenades, that's the sexy part. But wars are fought on logistics. The day an army runs out of food, there is no army anymore. So... just imagine the logistical issues of bringing in everything that people need by sea and then having to unload it on a beach. It's just beyond imagining.
Yeah, and you can build all the piers and wharfs you like, and some of them are still there, but it's not the same as a port, is it? Should we start? You mentioned food. Let's go on to food. To sum up the rations, and this isn't entire, but if you want to just sum it up, it would be bully beef. Fantastic stuff. Pour it out of the can, Matt. If British Army always loves, it varies the food to the climate. So in a cold climate, you get cold bully beef. In a hot climate, you get hot bully beef. Pour it out the can. Glutinous, horrible. Ugh. So bully beef.
Can you think of the worst, salty, can you think of the worst thing to be in an environment with not enough water? Let's give them salty, preserved beef in an oily, stinky tin. That's literally the worst thing you could give someone in those conditions. Horrific.
Yeah, and then they've got the bloody dog biscuits. Sorry, I don't know. But the dog biscuits...
You can say bloody, that's fine.
They're in the museums. They're certainly in the War Museum, Imperial. I think there's one in or two. And they used to carve things out of it.
let's just clarify what you're talking about here. Preserved biscuits from the Gallipoli campaign that were so hard and so inedible, blokes would carve their names and messages into the biscuits, and they're still perfectly preserved a century later. That's not a foodstuff. That's a block of concrete.
Now, you've got a quote from a New Zealand chap, Private Russell Weir. What does he have to say? I've been thinking, I've noticed that your Australian New Zealand accents are not as good as Gary Baines, who I think is the...
I love Gary Baines' Australian accent. It's awful, but it's awful it's just awful enough that it's great. If you don't know what we're talking about, go and listen to Pete and Gary's military history. You'll hear some fantastic accents. I won't, out of respect for our Anzac cousins, I won't do the New Zealand accent. Just imagine this, but with a slightly refined New Zealand accent. Bully beef and biscuits. You couldn't eat your biscuit dry. It was like chewing rock. You'd break your teeth in the biscuits if you got stuck into them. You had to soak it. For pudding, we used to have biscuits soaking in water and the jam all mixed up together. They issued you with a small tin of jam, perhaps four to a tin.
Now, the jam itself, people who are used to the Western Front will think, oh, plum and apple jam. No, it was apricot jam. And I'm with Homer Simpson. Apricots is proof, not of the existence of God, but the existence of the devil. It's ghastly stuff. So apricot jam. And then what else do they have? Well, again, you made to make your mouth water. It's just unbelievable. So you've got bacon. Salted, preserved bacon. Yeah. You've got cheese. You've got your TNT. McConaughey's, which is sort of lamb and thing. lamb and vegetables. Horrible, especially when it...
And, I'm assuming, Pete, that all this food is of the highest order as well, that when you say bacon, you're talking about, you know, boutique cured bacon, and when you say cheese, you mean some nice artisan blue cheese. Is that what we're talking about?
Yeah, not quite, Matt, not quite, no. The cheapest, horrible. I will say this, they did get enough food. It's just not very appetizing and very repetitive. Very, very repetitive. We'll perhaps come to something else about that later on. Wealthy officers, could they do anything about it? Any way a wealthy officer could improve it?
Well, they get the one thing that was always surprisingly consistent throughout the campaign was the mail from home, and not just letters. You could get parcels sent from home all the time. So wealthy officers would get a little hamper from home with all sorts of good things, a jar of cows for jelly or something in it. But even blokes in the front line, I've read accounts of cakes. Cake was a common, and I'm assuming some sort of fruit cake, if it had to travel all that distance. But I'm surprised by the number of accounts I read, even by private soldiers, saying they got a little bit of cake sent from home and shared it with all their mates, and how that bucked them up. So extraordinary that the mail kept getting through, when they couldn't even find where their battalions were, let alone individual privates.
Yeah, but this is... I've got a lovely account, which I just love this account because it sums up how you can send... You can be thoughtful and send something, but not thoughtful about what... What you said. This is Private Harold Thomas, he's a Suvla veteran, 3rd East Anglian Field Ambulance. We haven't got to Suvla yet, but imagine it's happened. I once saw a parcel consisting of cigarettes, that's good, cake, great, socks, yep, soap, in the midst of which a bunch of a dozen bananas had been inserted some 6 weeks earlier when the consignment had been proudly dispatched from an enthusiastic but woefully ignorant English homestead. That parcel would have been a good illustration for the phrase, the bondage of corruption. Even the socks seemed to have surrendered to the general dissolution. And people say, why, how can you find things funny? You know, people are dying all round it, and he's a medic. I mean, so. But the point is, the soldiers laugh at these things. I mean, you can just imagine them sat around thinking, "Oh, lovely, a parcel. And where's my cake?" And then,
bananas of all the bloody things to put bananas. One of my famous asides is that Australians in particular would have seen the famous Mel Gibson movie Gallipoli from 1981, made by Peter Weir. And that was, Pete may or may not be rolling his eyes in the background of that film, but regardless of what you think of it, one of the great Aussie war movies, but it was inspired by a parcel sent from home, because Peter Weir told the story about how in the 70s he went to Gallipoli and there was a lot of relics lying around. And he picked up an intact jar, which was a bottle of Eno's salts, the famous Eno salts used for indigestion. And he thought that was amazing that he was holding that in his hand because someone had sent that in a care parcel. That's how it had reached the soldier. A soldier had used it and then thrown it away, and he found it decades later. And so in the movie, when Mel Gibson is opening a care parcel from home and makes a joke about, oh, the old ducks must think we're on a picnic, they're including Eno salts in the parcel. I think it was actually the bottle that Peter Weir found at Gallipoli was what they used as the prop for the movie. And so, but that was the reason that movie got made, is because of a care parcel sent from home with Eno salts in it. And interestingly, to take the aside, when I did a dig in 2007 at Messines on the Western Front, one of the things I dug out of an Australian trench, a bottle of Eno salts. So it must have gotten around quite a bit. I wouldn't have thought they had enough food to get indigestion, but apparently they did. They needed their salts.
Well,
you ever found Eno salts on the battlefield, Pete?
Never, but I did enjoy the film, by the way. It's historically somewhat dubious, but a great war film. And we can all enjoy that. Now, the restricted diet causes some problems. They get septic sores, they often do, which means anything gets turned into a carbuncle-like thing, a great crater on your arm or leg. We ought to mention the water. With the water, you've indicated, local water supplies, how are they?
Pretty bloody awful, I think, is the technical term. I mean, I think in some places they were able to dig wells okay, particularly down at Helles, they were able to dig wells. But in other places, particularly Anzac, that wasn't an option in the rough terrain. And so water had to be brought in, if you can believe it, all the way from Egypt on barges. I mean, just think about it. It emphasises that point we made before. everything had to be brought in, including water. So water barges from Egypt in huge tanks. There's a fantastic photo in your book, Pete, showing, I think it's actually Māori pioneers from New Zealand, lugging by hand one of these huge tanks up onto Pluggies Plateau, one of the heights at Anzac. And we should also say, as a little aside again, is that one of those tanks is still there. If you go to the Neck, that famous Australian site where the charge was and the cemetery, an amazing site, but don't just look at the cemetery. Go across the car park and look in the scrub overlooking Monash Valley. And there is a water tank left over from the campaign in the scrub, which was probably dragged up after the war to supply water for the cemetery. But it is one of the original water tanks brought in from Egypt to give, you know, to keep the supply of water up to the Anzacs. And they're pretty big old tanks. But I tell you what, when you look at it, there's no way that, what are we talking about? Two divisions of men, you know, 20-odd thousand men are going to be kept nourished by just a couple of water tanks. So, I mean, obviously, a shortage of water was always an issue.
And I like to say, when we go on a walk, we always supply, as you know, on a tour, lots of bottles of water. And you realise, you know, sometimes you have a two-bottle walk or a four-bottle walk, and that one bottle would have been all you had for the day a lot of the time. And it makes you think.
And there's, of course, Pete, we should mention down at Hellers, Joe Murray's well. Joe Murray that we've heard from in previous episodes, we're going to hear from here. There is a well. He helped construct that well, didn't he, at Gully Beach?
So they say.
Regardless, yeah, there is a well built by British engineers at the mouth of Gully Ravine.
He says it was him.
Regardless, whoever built it, it's a great sight to see. It's still got some carbon.
Oh, it's a great sight to see.
Yeah, it's great. An original well from the campaign. Fantastic.
Now, the wells, they're often polluted by corpses if they're old, original ones, because the Turks just lob anything down there. But anyway, wherever you got water from, there was a fear of it being polluted. And this is a great quote by Lieutenant Leslie Grant of the 1st 4th Royal Scots. He says, "We get liquid of sorts by digging a hole in the trench and letting it silt up. Of course, it has to be boiled, but even then it's the colour of milk and as gritty as a grindstone. Tea takes the taste away a bit, but the men say they can tell by the taste whether a Tommy or a Turk is buried beside their particular well." And again, squatty humour. Squatty humour hasn't changed from then till now.
Well, Cecil Malthus, the New Zealander who served with the Canterburys that we featured in the previous episode, he did a lot of fighting at Hellers during the Battle of Krithia. He's one of the key characters in my upcoming Krithia book. But he tells a most disheartening story along the same lines, that when they were marching up into the line at Cape Helles, they were delighted to find a creek with water flowing down. So they filled up their water bottles and quenched their thirst. And of course, the next morning, marched just around the corner of the creek, and it was full of dead Turks. And they'd been drinking the water from downstream all evening. So no wonder they got sick, mate. I mean, we're going to talk about this a little bit later, but no wonder they got sick. This is the quality of the water they're drinking.
It is, and Gallipoli is a dry, hot place most of the time. We'll come to it, but dry, hot place. It's dusty. It's like a dust bowl. That all the vegetation sort of goes because it's all used to boiler tea and the rest of it all blown up. The troops are, these are not special to Gallipoli, but the troops are riddled with lice. Filthy, dirty and ragged would be a bit like my own personal dress sense, as if you ever come on a Matt McLaughlin tour with me, you see filthy, dirty and scruffy. But one thing is really important to health and the lifestyle, is the flies. And the flies are just everywhere. They're omnipresent. They're just amazing. And you've got a quote. What's this quote you want to tell us?
This is Ian Idris from the 5th Australian Light Horse. Fantastic account of Gallipoli. I can't remember the title of his book, but it's an absolute ripper. And this is quite a well-known quote of his, which I think sums it up pretty well. This describes him trying to have a simple meal, have his lunch or his breakfast at Gallipoli. "I wrapped my overcoat over the tin and gouged out the flies." This is jam he's talking about. "And gouged out the flies and then spread the biscuit, held my hand over it and drew the biscuit out of the coat. But a lot of flies flew into my mouth and beat about inside. I nearly howled with rage. Of all the bastards of places, this is the greatest bastard in the world." I think we can wrap up now, Pete. We can wrap up the whole series. Ian Idris has just summed it up better than anyone
could. I think he did.
Pete, I've heard the expression. You're probably going to talk about it later on, but I'm going to jump in early. They say that you could smell Gallipoli before you could see it when you're on the boat on the way there. Is that true, or is that just a good illustration of how filthy it was?
I believe it to be true. If you've ever had a dead mouse or I remember a dead goat or something that was near the French guns at Gallipoli, and you could smell it 100 yards away. So take that as thousands of bodies lying. And after that truce at Anzac, after the attack on 19th of May, they didn't allow truces because they thought it would dishearten the Turks, have to charge across lots and lots of corpses. Of course, it would dishearten us, and we were mainly attacking, but never mind. The corpses in between the lines just lie out in the open. Even in your trenches, they're just buried in the side of the trench, hence the last quote I read. For instance, the men killed at the neck in that famous attack on the morning of the 7th of August, they lie there for the rest of the campaign. And the stench must have been indescribable. But let's talk about the truce, because there was a truce with the 24th of May when they clear away. They have a truce to clear the bodies on the killed at in the Turkish attack, mass attack on the 19th of May. And it wasn't just a mass attack; it was a mass slaughter as well. Who's the best quote for that? I think
We're going to hear from Lieutenant Colonel Percy Fenwick. From the headquarters of the New Zealand and Anzac Division. And here's what he had to say, the sight that greeted him. The Turkish dead lay so thick that it was almost impossible to pass without treading on their bodies. The stench was awful. The Turkish doctor gave me some pieces of wool on which he poured some scent and asked me to put them into my nostrils. I was glad to do so. The awful destructive power of high explosives was very evident. Huge holes, surrounded with circles of corpses blown to pieces, were scattered about the area over which we walked. Everywhere lay the dead, swollen, black, and hideous, and over all a nauseating stench that made one feel desperately sick.
I can't imagine what the smell was like. It must have been awful. And remember, for instance, if you're one of the light horse holding the neck after the attack, those people out there are your mates. And you could see them rotting. You can smell them rotting. Now, why have we mentioned we've gone from flies to corpses? Now we're going to talk about latrines, or as I always say, let's talk about bottoms, Matt. Because the thing is, your average fly loves corpses. You imagine it flying about to a corpse, and it loves latrines. And you've got an unsuitable diet. You've got putrid corpses, you've got flies, you've got latrines, and it's a perfect circle. And when I say circle, I mean circle, because it spreads the disease round and round. And this is a quote from, this isn't me, this is Sir Arthur Hurst in his magnificent book, which I know you have next to your bedside, Medical Diseases of the War. And he says this: house flies are much the most important means of spreading dysentery. Their two favourite articles of diet are faeces, that's shit, and jam. And I told you, apricot jam was sent by the devil. And the thing is that the fly goes from the corpses to the latrines, and then your quote, poor old, trying to get you a bit of bread or a bit of bully beef, and it goes into your mouth, and dysentery starts. And thousands of men are soon suffering from dysentery. This isn't the sort of upset tummy that we've often discussed from 6 pints of Australian lager and an unwise curry or a dodgy kebab. That's an upset tummy. This is dysentery. And here's and remember, they're in an isolated place with no logistics, there's no toilets, there's just open trenches or the old stick and pole. And they've got no way of washing the muck away. When you hear the next quote, just remember that thing you read in a toilet. Now wash your hands. And some dirty buggers don't. But this is ordinary seaman Joe Murray. I won't do the accent out of respect for something that's coming up later. He was with the Hood Battalion, Royal Naval Division. With dysentery, you keep on trying to discharge something, but there's nothing to discharge. It's only slime, just slime, no solids at all. Then, of course, we didn't have any toilet paper, and you had to wipe yourself with your hand. There's nothing else. Then you'd wipe your hand, originally on the grass, but grass was getting a bit short. You rub your hands on the sand and your trousers. And that means once it starts, that it's just murder. The disease spreads like wildfire.
Something I really want to point out that's important too, Pete, is that he told you that personally. Joe Murray, the reason we have that quote is you asked him the question, what was it like having dysentery? And he told you. And you've made the excellent point so many times, including on years ago on my Living History podcast when we talked about interviewing these veterans, the importance of oral history, that they're not going to write this in their diary. They're certainly not going to write it home in a letter to their girlfriend that I was up all night shitting myself. And so it's only oral history that reveals these really important aspects of what it's like to actually serve in a war zone. And it's only because it's a wonderful thing that you've done, Pete. We all have to be grateful for what you've done here, because he only told you that because he believed in you. He knew that you got it. He knew that you were there to tell his story. And now we've got these incredible accounts. And this is quotes like this from Joe Murray changed our perspective on what went wrong at Gallipoli, because this is a huge part of it.
And the next one I also interviewed, I remember him well, but he was in Leamington Spa. You're going to do a quote from Private William Cowley. He was the Army Service Corps, the 11th Div. So I think that's Suvla, I would imagine. What does he say?
You felt so weak with dysentery, you'd got no strength. You were as weak as a kitten. The doctor asked me one night how many times I went to the latrines. I said 16 times. You rush out there, and when you get there, you couldn't do anything. And we start, Pete, I think the thing that's important here, Pete, is we're starting to get the idea. Debilitating. That is the word for this. I tell you what, a modern army with how well-trained and fit and agile young people are in the modern military would struggle in this terrain to fight just because of the landscape and the climate. Add now to them absolutely chronic diarrhea, abdominal pains, bleeding, everything else that goes with dysentery. I mean, geez, that's the quickest way to absolutely decimate an army. It's horrific.
And this is a quote from Ordinary Seaman Stephen Moyle, another one I interviewed. These are, because you don't get this in letters and diaries. He was with the Drake Battalion, RND. He's talking about the latrines. If you'd looked in there, you'd have been sickened. You'd think they'd parted with their stomachs or their insides. It was awful. You had to cover it and dig another. It hadn't to be so high or else you could fall down. There were no supports or anything. It was just an open trench, but it was fairly deep. And again, you raised it, but Iraq, diarrhea and vomiting. That's diarrhea, not dysentery. It's a three-day thing. Dysentery, you just don't get better unless you're, given substantial time for recovery.
These blokes are lucky to make it to the latrines in a way, because, I mean, guys were soiling their pants. They were walking around covered in shit. I mean, apologies if you're eating your breakfast while you're listening to this or something, but this is the reality of war. We can't shy away from it. And I don't like how we always, particularly when it comes to Gallipoli, we go down the path of the heroic Anzacs and, you know, representing Australia and all that stuff. Of course, that's an element of it. But at the same time, the poor guys are shitting their guts up. And it's just horrific. This is the reality of Gallipoli.
Well, the next quote, I remember sitting opposite when he told me, and I think I must have had my mouth open, because this is one of the worst quotes I've ever heard. It's by Ordinary Seaman Joe Murray again, Hood Battalion. And this might upset you, listeners. My old pal, a couple of weeks ago, he was as smart and upright as a guardsman. After about 10 days to see him crawling about, his trousers around his feet, his backside hanging out, all soiled, his shirt, everything was soiled. He couldn't walk. My pal got hold of him by one arm. I got hold of him by the other. Neither he nor I were very good, but we weren't like that. It's degrading dragging him to the latrine when you remember how you saw him just a little while ago. We lower him down next to the latrine. We're trying to keep the flies off him. We were trying to turn him round to put his backside in towards the trench. I don't know what happened, but he simply rolled into this foot-wide trench, half sideways, head first into this slime. We couldn't pull him out. We didn't have any strength, and he couldn't help himself at all. We did eventually get him out, but he was dead. He drowned in his own excrement. And I will point this out. He actually died in other people's excrement, if you follow the story closely. People say, is that story true? I believed him as he told it, and I do believe it to be true.
I've heard it in his own words. I've heard and you, I mean, if you're listening to this and you want to, you know, subject yourself to it, you can download that interview for free that Pete did back in the 80s, I think it was, wasn't it, Pete?
And, yeah, 83.
You can download that in the Imperial War Museum, but a lot of it is fascinating, but a lot of it is harrowing as well. And when you hear Joe, in his own words, tell that story, what can you say?
And the thing is, that wasn't all they suffered from. In the Western Desert in the Second World War, if you got jaundice, you'd be evacuated and given a chicken diet. If you got jaundice at Gallipoli, you were complimented on the attractive yellow tint in your complexion. I mean, you go nowhere. Paratyphoid, I once got in trouble with a certain regiment by saying everything beginning with the word para is bad. I had to apologise. It's enteric fever. What are some of the symptoms? Headaches, stomach pains, diarrhoea. More diarrhoea. Hooray! Bronchial cough. Spots, high temperature, etc. It's debilitating again. Another problem for those who'd served at the 29th Division, not the Australians, but 29th Division, they'd been out in the Far East and they'd got, several had got malaria. And then there was something called soldier's heart. And this, I had people telling me about. It's a disordered action of the heart. It's a cardiacal disorder. It's caused by overexertion, mental strain, lack of sleep, and a body weakened by toxic disease. It isn't usually fatal, but what it is, can you imagine? It's basically you're as if you're a 90-year-old. You've got a disordered action of the heart. You can't. Your body's closing down. Can you imagine? This is why poor old Monash's 4th Brigade, when they do the sweep round on the night of the 6th, 7th, that brigade's riddled with dysentery. And some of the soldiers will have had soldier's heart. Is there such a disease as soldier's heart? No, there isn't such a disease as shell shock either. These are symptoms. This is what it's like.
Just on that point, Pete, I mean, we can't stress it enough, but riddled with dysentery. I mean, not every man had every disease, but many of them had several. Everyone is weak. Everyone is feeling worn out, weak as a kitten, fluttering hearts, you know, dysentery. And then, of course, it's not enough they just got to hold the trench. Then you got to put a rifle in their hand and say, now go and attack the enemy. I mean, now you start to get a picture of what was going on. And, of course, it was the same for the Turks as well. They were in the same condition. So two armies facing each other, at the absolute end of their tether, just horrific.
Well, if everybody ill had gone home, there'd be nobody left.
One size fits all seems like a good idea for clothes until you try them on. Same goes for healthcare. That's why United Healthcare offers flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
Should we move on to a daily routine? Because there's a routine in everything in life, and there is a routine in trench life. I describe it, and I do describe it, as a sordid, filthy monotony slashed by sudden death. And just to give us
poetic,
an idea...
Pete, you should be a writer.
I've just made a gesture, listeners, to Matt, which is fortunate you can't see. I use two fingers, not one, though. Right.
We do need to lighten the mood a little bit after that. So,
well, I'm sorry that I mean, people often ask why I'm such an idiot at times, and I'm quite a sensitive soul underneath this, and I find quotes like Murray's appalling. Yeah. But here's one from an Australian hero, a true Australian hero, Colonel John Monash, who commanded the 4th Australian Brigade I was just talking about. What does he say, Matt?
Well, we're going to talk about the routine of daily trench life, but the one thing I wanted to say about Monash before I get to that is... everyone at Gallipoli was suffering from dysentery, from privates to generals. And I remember Monash, in part of his notes, said, if we ever have a solid movement again, we'll feel like we're in the family way. That's how he described it. He was a colonel. So it showed what was going on. But this is what he had to say about daily life in the trenches. And that's the other thing too. Sorry, but this is not the quote from Monash. That's still coming. This is still Matt talking. But that's the thing as well, is that there's no rear area. We said that. There's nowhere for the privates to go and get away and take a break. But there's no safe area for the commanders either. Monash's headquarters was a few hundred metres behind, well, you know, 100 metres behind the front line. So the commanders are in it just as much as the men. So this is what he had to say about daily life. We have been amusing ourselves by trying to discover the longest period of absolute quiet. We've been fighting now continuously for 22 days, all day and all night, and most of us think that absolutely the longest period during which there was absolutely no sound of gun or rifle fire throughout the whole of that time was 10 seconds. One man says he was able on one occasion to count to 14, but nobody believes him.
I think that, again, a touch of humour, even from someone regarded as a bit of a sober sides. That's not an insult, because you need sober sides in war as well as jokers. And they've got no real accommodation. A lot of them just, they can hollow out cubby holes. The Australians have got a name for it, which I've forgotten. Little cubby holes to the side of their trench. Or they just sleep on the fire step, or just lying on the bottom of the trench. And here's a quote from Lieutenant George Hughes, 5th Dorsetshire Regiment. They were at Suvla. There's so little room for the men to sleep in the firing line that they have to sleep on the firing step. Many of them, and some actually prefer to lie at full length on the floor and put up with the kicks of the patrolling officer. They never wake. I suppose a really tired man seldom does. And that gives you the idea. They must have been, I'm going to say, knackered, exhausted, stressed out of their heads. I mean, I don't know how they coped.
Well, if you're going for the only period of silence you're getting between rifle shots is 10 seconds after 22 days on the peninsula, you're not getting a lot of sleep even when you are rostered on for a bit of a kip. You're not getting much sleep.
Yeah, a disturbed sleep. And in the morning, of course, they'd have stand to. Then they'd be put on. They have a rota for sentry duty. But let's talk about some of the risks of, because we haven't mentioned snipers yet. Why haven't we? And I accept your point. They're not really snipers. They're just people, individuals with rifles. And later on, there are some famous snipers.
Well, they're good marksmen at the end of the day. I mean, both sides are picking the blokes that are the best shots to go out and try to pick off officers. So I guess by that definition, they absolutely are snipers. But don't think of them in terms of World War II Germans with specially modified rifles and telescopic sights. These are just good marksmen put in good positions.
And if you're the sentry, you're just going to peek over the top for a couple. You know, you're not going to sit there with your head over the top. Well, you get a bullet through it. Now, one thing I will say that is better at Gallipoli. It is better. And what's that? It's the artillery situation, isn't it? Would you like to comment on this a bit, Matt?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's fascinating when you read these accounts of Gallipoli and men talking about it was the heaviest bombardment I'd ever seen. I didn't know how anyone could live through it. That's actually true. It was the heaviest bombardment they'd seen up until that point. But a year later on the Western Front, it would be considered just a warm up. And the First World War on the Western Front was an artillery war, even by this stage, even by 1915. The war was being won or lost, and battles were being won or lost by the artillery. And it was simply a case that the Turks didn't have enough heavy guns, and the Allies couldn't land enough guns. They were undersupplied anyway. So even though there was a decent amount of firing of artillery at Gallipoli, it wasn't anything compared to what was going on the Western Front.
And how about another quote from Monash to 4th Australian Brigade to Colonel John Monash to illustrate the situation?
So Monash says, "The noises of the battlefield are numerous and varied, and after a little while it is quite easy to distinguish the different sounds. The bullet which passes close by, say within 10 or 20 feet, has a gentle purring hum, like a low caressing whistle long drawn out. The bullet which passes well overhead, especially if fired from a long range, has a sharp sudden crack like a whip, and really feels as if it's very close. Our own rifle fire, listened to from behind the firing line, sounds like a low rumble or growl. Our machine guns are exactly like the rattle of a kettle drum. The enemy shrapnel sounds like a gust of wind in a wintry gale, swishing through the air and ending in a loud bang and a cloud of smoke when the shell bursts. Our own artillery is the noisiest of all, both the discharge of the guns and the bursting of the shells being air-splitting. with a reverberating echo that lasts 20 or 30 seconds.
Yeah.
Mate, it's little wonder that these veterans were all deaf when they came home.
Yeah, and you know, there wasn't much artillery, but if you were close to it, it was bad. And this is a quote from the detonation of the shell. Sorry, I mean, this is Private Harry Baker, Chatham Battalion, Royal Naval Division. You crouched as low down in the trench as you could, right flat down in the trench and as near to the parapet as you could, because you hoped that any explosion would be behind you. The ground used to rock and chunks of high explosive used to fly like cats meowing. So long as you heard the explosion, you were all right. If you didn't hear the explosion, you were not there anymore. And that's the old thing that, you know, you don't hear the one that hits you. You hear the others. This is perhaps a time to mention there was a harassing fire by the Turks. And most famously at Helles, that was from Asiatic Annie. And it's supposed to be Asiatic Annie in the high street of Çanakkale. We'll probably have a look at that in next year. What about that old staple of the battlefield, machine guns? The Turks do have them by this time. They don't have them much under landings, in the sense that they arrive later in the day. But machine guns are there, aren't they? And they are, yeah, they are deadly.
This is the story of Gallipoli, especially if we focus on Anzac for a minute. I mean, the case was the same at Helles, but we're talking a slightly larger area and a little bit flatter in terrain. At Anzac, I get asked this all the time, Pete. People say, why couldn't they just advance? If they brought up reinforcements, why could they not push through? Just what was going on? You know, I've been there. No man's land's only 2 metres wide. Surely they could have run across that in a heartbeat. The answer is machine guns. If you stand, particularly, I always think Courtney's post at Gallipoli, it's not there anymore, but there's a sign marking where it was. It's kind of on high ground. It's sort of, and it looks back down along the front line, and there's now a road along Second Ridge, which basically traces no man's land. So you can stand at somewhere like Courtney's, look along that ridge, and what you find is that road bends and winds and curves back on itself and doubles back, and you can guarantee that in every nook and cranny there was a machine gun. And the machine guns were not, I mean, we've done podcasts about this before, machine guns were not firing straight across no man's land. Machine guns were set up to fire along no man's land. And so if you imagine that if there's a nice curve in the trench line, you're going to set up a machine gun there and you're going to dial that machine gun in to fire directly along no man's land, and then 10 metres down the line you'll have another machine firing across that one, so there'll be a crossfire. And just imagine a network of crossfire all the way along no man's land. Everywhere there's a bend in the line, any man who stepped out into no man's land was going to meet an absolute wall of machine gun bullets from both directions. At Courtney's post there were 9 machine guns in that one, you know, we're talking 20 metres of trench. There were 9 machine guns in that position alone. And even if we talk about attacks like at the Neck, the famous attack of the Light Horse at the Neck, where they were mown down by machine gun fire, most of that machine gun fire was coming from the right flank down no man's land, hitting them and forcing them left. So it wasn't coming from directly in front of them. So, and we found when we were there last time we were there, Pete, we found in the Turkish lines an area that was almost certainly a machine gun position because it was attached to a bit of a trench, but it stuck out in front. It was a very shallow scrape. There was enough space for 2 or 3 men to get in there, connected to the main trench line, and it was stuck in a position that gave it zero observation across no man's land, but a wonderful line straight down no man's land.
Now, another aspect of life at Gallipoli, which is a bit of a surprise to the British, you weren't ready for it at all, is hand grenades. Or bombs. They were called bombs. If you ever read an account of Gallipoli and they talk about bombs, they mean hand grenades. And when you're close together, they're all over the place. You can throw into the next trench quite easily, and it is easily done. Now let's have
Pete
a
may
a
wonder
quote.
What I'm doing. Pete may wonder what I'm doing in the background here, and all the rattling that you can hear, dear listener, because unexpectedly for him, we've got a bit of show and tell.
Ooh,
you can't see this, but I will post a photo. These are, if you can see that, Pete, on our screen, some beautifully preserved chunks of a Turkish cricket ball grenade that I picked up in Gallipoli.
Wow,
amazing! At Hill 60. So you can still, so that's why grenades are important. You're still finding chunks of them lying all over the battlefield. Quite extraordinary. Bombs, as we call them.
Bombs, yeah. Well, that's sort of the physical evidence. I think the second or third interview I ever did was with a chap called Second Lieutenant Malcolm Hancock, 1st, 4th, Northants. And you're going to make me relive this whole experience by going through the quote. Because this is the thing about oral history. It's not always interesting, but what's in it? So when you listen to this, you might think, wow, this is a bit long-winded and dull, but actually listen to the information within it, which just sums up. And this is not sort of Matt or me saying this. This is a guy who was there, a guy who was a bombing officer. So he has a great perspective. What does he say about the sort of bombs? This is 2nd Lieutenant Malcolm Hancock of the 1st 4th North Ants. And he was at Hill 60, which is
where
why
I found that... Where, yes, I found that Turkish grenade.
He might have, well, thrown it back, but had it thrown at him or thrown it back. You go, tell me what he says again, and I'll relive that moment of sitting opposite thinking, when's it my dinner time? Where's my coffee? Which is what oral historians do.
This is what 2nd Lieutenant Malcolm Hancock had to say. One was what we called a jam tin, into which was put a charge of explosive. It was filled with all kinds of odds and ends, bits of stone, flint, empty cartridges, bits of iron, nails. Then a fuse was inserted into a detonator. The neck of the detonator was crimped together to hold the fuse into the detonator. It was put in through the top of the lid down into the explosive, and then you've probably got 4 or 5 inches of fuse exposed. In order to use it, you would hold it in one's left hand, and the thing was that to light the fuse, you had to be darn careful not to show a light at night. I often would use the end of my cigarette. We were always smoking. That was very effective. Then as soon as you heard it begin to fizz, you kept it for 2 or 3 seconds. Not too long, but not too soon either. You tried to get it to explode on landing. It wouldn't be in the air very long, and you had to try to get your timing right. You hoped it dropped into the Turkish trench.
Now, I think that's great detailed information. Yes, you can get it off the printed page, but I'd rather hear you or him say. The other thing is, I point out that quote goes on to then describe in detail the cricket ball bomb, the hairbrush bomb, and how they had a catapult arrangement, the leech catapult to fire bombs, and then how they'd go into no man's land, retrieve Turkish bombs that hadn't gone off, and use them. And that's the beauty of oral history. It's detailed, and it's not always accurate, but
Pete, what does that detail tell us again about Gallipoli? Disorganisation. They get to Gallipoli and they discover that instead of a courageous advance across the plains to Constantinople, they're dug in this hell on earth of trenches, and they need hand grenades, which they didn't bring with them. So instead, who equips an army to make your own hand grenades out of a jam tin?
Well,
I mean, we talk about it, you know, the ingenuity and all that sort of stuff, but what a metaphor for the lack of preparation and the absolute, you know, threadbare situation the soldiers found themselves in.
And they didn't have them on the Western Front when they first got there either. I mean, the Germans did. Bloody Germans. Why do they think of these things? I mean, I will glide past the next bits. There's listening posts sometimes, if there's a bit of space between the lines. The patrolling is not a big feature at Gallipoli because it's very difficult to patrol at Quinn's Post. If you're patrolling, you're attacking there. But they were carried out.
The trench lines are about 2 metres apart. A patrol would be a 20-centimetre patrol, and you'd get your head blown off. Yeah. So
let's go back to rest camps. They do have because you've got to remember they weren't always in the line. They do circulate around, and this is very well at Anzac, where, as you know, they're in the front line, or they come back to rest gully, or below the Russell's and
Pluggies,
or they go to Reserve Gully, which is the other side, where they're still not exactly safe. The British at Helles, everywhere's in view and everywhere's in fire. And this is what I love this bloke. This is letters. Not, I wish I could have interviewed him, but he was killed in the Somme in 16. This is Major Norman Burge of the Nelson Battalion. And this is classic squaddy humour from an officer. I've been puzzling why it's called a rest camp. The only solution I can think of is that some of the bullets hit the trenches and the rest come over to us. Short quote that. That's officer's humour. Sorry, I'm joking about. But a real squaddy opinion is when you're at rest camp, does the British Army leave you alone? Does it let you put your feet up and have that 2 or 3 days off? Does it? Does it, buggery? And this is able seaman Thomas McMillan, Nelson Battalion. God, he was a moaning bastard. I've read his account, and he's a proper Scotty. He reminds me of Gary. He will say he doesn't moan. He observes. He's observing a lot here. So Abel Seaman Thomas McMillan. Of working parties, there seemed no end. Our division was kept on the trot so constantly that they became known as the White Slaves of Gallipoli. As a result of overwork, tempers went from bad to worse. On being detailed for fatigue, troops would sing aloud, even in the presence of the officers. Working, 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 always bloody well working, working in the morning and working all day long. And this would be followed by muttered curses, coarse and gross.
It's not never here. It's not high art, is it? But it gets the message across.
Yeah, it's not the right tune either. I just made that up. But,
I liked it.
I mean, soldiers do complain and moan. It's when they don't moan at all that their morale's gone. You know, sullen silence is the worst sign.
I think it's on that point, it's interesting that the statistics indicate that as the Gallipoli campaign went on, this is an Anzac quote, but I'm sure it applied at Helles as well, that as things dragged on, rates of sickness and men reporting with injuries seemed to spike later in the campaign. And there's a bit of a disparity there. Historians can't quite understand that because the fighting was actually dying down, but more men were turning up to report injuries. And the answer was they were seeking treatment for things they would previously been enduring because they were, you know, just they were copping it, they were doing their best, they were carrying on regardless. But as the campaign wore on, they started to become disillusioned. So then they weren't so concerned with, oh, bugger it, I'll head down to the medical office and get a break from the front line.
And while they're putting up with it, this laugh or cry mentality goes on. And amusing incidents are absolutely treasured. And here's, I love this posh officer who describes in heroic terms their titanic battle with a Turkish mouse. And you're going to be Sir Patrick Duff, Sir Patrick Duff, of 460th Battery, Royal Field Artillery. I think he was a captain.
We what killed a mouse, say? He said, we killed a mouse today, Staveley having 5 shots at it with a revolver. The excitement was something frightful. If my British warm doesn't come, I had better keep the skin.
Yeah, they're starting. That's, you can tell that's late in the campaign. They're starting to worry about what the weather's going to do. Yeah. There was also, I love this next quote. It's an early element, an early indication of propaganda. Propaganda warfare. And this is Private Harold Boughton, 2nd 1st London Regiment. There were tons of tortoises, and sometimes we used to get them, make a little hole in the shell on their back.
Did you say tortoises?
Yeah.
Tortoises.
What's this? Tortoises.
Tortoises. Sorry, I interrupted, but I didn't think people would understand. A little turtle, a mini turtle. Sorry, I interrupted. Carry on. Tortoises.
However you say it, now I've gone red with embarrassment of my ignorance. A little hole in the shell on their back, which is a bit cruel, Matt. Please do not do this at home. You probably have turtles in Australia. Stick a piece of wood into it, cut a niche in the wood, and put a piece of card in it with a rude message to Johnny Turk. We steered them off towards the Turkish trenches. Well, I suppose they could read it, but anyway, it occupied some time. And I just imagine a point of view. Bastard Turks and sending it off the tortoise wandering across the kid. My back hurts. Oh, well.
Oh, dear. What about, just with all this going on, Pete, the one thing it makes me think of is how were the men holding up? Like, how were they going with all of this going on? I mean, we mentioned before that as the campaign dragged on, they started reporting sick more often, they started reporting injuries. I mean, tell me about morale. How was that going?
Well, it fluctuates, but it basically gets worse. They never get a day off. This is the point. There's never a all right, sometimes most units were cycled through for 3 or 4 days on Imbros, but that's later in the campaign. They basically just stay there. That's it. You just stay there, and you're always in danger. You're shitting yourself. There's a lovely quote from a young officer, Second Lieutenant Rupert Westermacott of the Auckland Battalion, and he hears 2 veterans discussing the situation. And I love this quote. It'll be best in an Australian accent, so you better do it.
he's an Aucklander, and there is a swear here, so cover your kiddies' ears if you're driving them to school or something, but this is what he had to say. I got in this shell hole, and I heard these two men talking, and one of them said, "I don't know, what's the matter with me?" And the other said, "I know, it's what the newspapers call demoralise. Fucking well demoralised."
And that sums it up. Most of them keep on going. And that's the thing we want to emphasise. Most of them keep going. And it's what you said, Matt. People report sick far more in between battles than during. And I've got nothing but admiration for them. Earlier, I just mentioned the weather. And it's always sunny at Gallipoli, isn't it, Matt? Always.
Yeah, I mean, we're about to talk about the thing that I think surprises people probably more than anything else when we talk about Gallipoli. It is boiling in summer, but I tell you what, it's cold in winter. And those of us who've been there in winter, it is bloody freezing. It snows there regularly at Gallipoli. It gets very, very cold. So we think of it, probably because the campaign's bookended over the summer months as well, as we think of it as this sort of hot, balmy flies, desert, you know, heat, 40 degrees every day. Not by November. Tell us what happened in November, yeah. Pete.
Well, in November, I've forgotten the date, back end of November, 29th, somewhere around there, it starts to rain. And it pours down. It's like tropical rainfall, except it's not. It's continental Europe, freezing cold, drenching rain. Nobody's taken any notice of them. Where were a lot of the dugouts and where the units? Rest Gully, places like that. What's the word that binds them together? And that is the word gully. What forms a gully, Matt?
I think it might be flowing water, Pete, forms it.
Again, it is.
When you get there in April, when you live at Gallipoli through July and August and on, they're dry gullies. But as you say, they've got to have water in them eventually, and in November they do.
And worst for this, because it's due to the length, are Anzac and Helots. That's because there's no space to get much water in Anzac. Although it does happen, but not as bad as this. This is a quote from, he told me, ordinary seaman Joe Murray, Hood Battalion, and he's in Gully Ravine, and he sees what's happening. And the water is dammed up by debris or actual trench lines. And then breaks, and he says this: "All of a sudden, the dam would break, and the whole volume of water came down, carrying everything before it. Corpses, all sorts of gear, some people drowning. On our side of the gully, the water came so much down the trench that it was cascading over the cliffs into the gully. The Turks were standing about, and so were we. There was no trench to go to. They were full up of water. It was raining like hell. They were standing there. We made no attempt to do anything. We couldn't. Half of us didn't have any rifles. They'd been flooded in the trench somewhere. The Turks could have walked through as far as they liked. There was no defence at all. Not where we were. Everywhere was washed up. Fellows ill with dysentery had fallen down and drowned in their own communication trenches. And of course other people were going down them walking on them. It wasn't till after the storm that we realised what a lot of people were drowned." Some exaggeration there, I'm going to, you know, admit. But what I want you, Matt, is to get the feel of what's happening. And if you've been in Gully Ravine, you can picture the water pouring from the trenches on either side and building up in it. So what could happen that's worse than rain? Torrential rain, they were all wet now. What could make the situation worse? What could it be, Matt?
Does it get a touch chilly, Pete, in November in Gallipoli?
It's awful. It freezes. It freezes. And it drops well below zero. And
this area we're talking about, where Joe Murray gave that quote from, again, the geography, go back and listen to the episode where Pete described the peninsula with his hand. And we're talking about the big gully on the sort of the western side, the left of the Allied line. Huge gully, the beautiful tautology of Gully Ravine. But it's both a gully and a ravine. That's how deep it is. But it is huge. It's, you know, how high are those cliffs, Pete? 30 or 40 feet on each side. It's a massive ravine.
Well, it goes up to 70 feet, yeah.
Oh, wow. Okay, so it's a huge gully. It's a huge ravine. And, of course, it's been formed by water running through the bottom of it. And we've been there, Pete. We hacked our way up it and couldn't get any further. And that was in the summer because it had been raining and it all washed out. So I can't imagine when you've built such fixed positions there and then the water comes rushing down and then it freezes. And the cold wind starts howling in, the piers get washed away, the water that's on the ground freezes, you're soaked in your uniform, your woolen uniform, the worst thing you could be wearing in the rain, it's freezing, it's snowing, it's awful.
Well, some of the British are in khaki drill, which is even worse because it may be woolen or whatever, but it's thin. I can't imagine what it was like in those trenches. But luckily, we've got Private Harold Boughton of the 2nd 1st London Regiment. He was at Suvla where it hit worse because it's a big open plain and it was just worse. What does Harold say, Matt?
He says, "My pal and I, Corporal Dean, sat on two empty tin biscuit boxes up against the wall of the trench. We pulled some blankets over our head, some ground sheets over that, put our arms around each other and sat like that all through the night with water right over our boots. There was nowhere else to go, so we sat there until the morning. When we tried to move, we could lift those blankets and ground sheets off us like bent sheets of corrugated iron. Our feet, well, they were frozen in the water and we could hardly move to pull them out. All around us there were chaps moaning and crying. Some of the sentries standing on the fire steps had frozen stiff, and when they were touched fell over. Frozen. I had frostbite in my hands and feet. Some of them were so bad that they were told to get down to the beach as soon as they could. That was the only place they could be treated, but there was no road and no means of taking them down there. I saw men crawling on their hands and knees. Grown-up men crying like babies. Even the quartermaster sergeant of the Royal Marines." Pete, this really was one of the worst times for many men at Gallipoli, wasn't it? Ironically, when we think of the August offensive and the heat and the stench and the bully beef and all the stuff we've described. But I've heard a lot of veterans say that the worst, and probably because it came at the end when all hope was lost, but the worst time, the last kick in the teeth, was when the big storms came in and they all froze. Just how much more could they endure?
Well, one great thing is that the good old, you know, the war with Bulgaria meant that the Turks could actually get some proper artillery and shells through. So places like Anzac, where they'd been immune behind the, not immune, but they'd been relatively safe. I want to make that, I don't want to contradict what we said earlier, but relatively safe. Everywhere came under threat, even more threat of fire, of things that actually always went bang, as opposed to Turkish shells, which didn't always go bang. Now, let one last quote sums up the sheer embuggerance and annoyance of Gallipoli. Even when you think, there must be an upside to this, there isn't, because it's just all down, really. It's not a great place. Now, and no better words for me than the bloke that started my career as an oral historian in many ways, the best interview that made me realise what was possible, Ordinary Seaman Joe Murray of the Hood Battalion. He says, he's talking about his shirt. He said, "I spread it on a stone in the trench behind me. It had been 3 days in a solid block of ice. And do you know, I looked at this shirt, and believe it or not, the blinking lice were still alive and crawling all over the shirt. They'd been 3 days in a block of ice. You'd have thought that would have killed the damn things, but it didn't." So when it unfroze, bloody lice were still there. Now, I don't know whether that's true or not. But for me, that sums up the misery of life at Gallipoli. It sums up that even when you think, at least the lice will be dead. Nope, they're still alive. What do you say to that, Matt?
I say that, whether true or not, that sums up at least Joe's attitude to everything that was going on. It's not enough that my bloody shirt is frozen solid. I've still got to deal with the lice. I actually have heard that from Anzacs, now that you mentioned. I've heard them say that it seemed that the cold weather got rid of the freezing shirts, got rid of the lice, and as soon as you put them back on, body heat warmed them up, and you could feel the creeping crawling again. I mean, I think that sums it up. It's been a hell of a journey. It's been hard to push through some of this, Pete. These are some very real and very difficult accounts of Gallipoli, but important that we tell the whole story and that we understand. When we go to Anzac Day and stand there and pay our respects, that we understand just the, you know, the depth of the respect that we owe them, because it's just quite hideous and a fascinating episode. Next week we're going to go back to the killing and the attacking and the major battles, because we've got the big one coming up, the August offensive, the big flanking manoeuvre to try and win the campaign for the Allies one last time. And I don't think it's a spoiler to say that it didn't quite go according to plan.
No. Looking forward to it, Matt.
Like everything at Gallipoli. Pete, thank you again, and I'll talk to you next week.
Cheers.
Thanks for listening. Don't forget to subscribe and leave a review for the podcast, and visit livinghistorytv.com for more great history content.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. HelloFresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.